The MLB's mid-season ban on generative AI tools in dugout iPads is on the surface a sports governance story, but it's actually a fascinating case study in how AI adoption happens faster than the rules designed to govern it. About a third of MLB teams, roughly 10 franchises, had been using generative AI tools on league-provided tablets during games to shape real-time tactical decisions. The kinds of applications reportedly included pitching strategy adjustments, defensive shift recommendations, and in-game lineup optimization. The ban came mid-season, meaning teams that had built game management workflows around these tools now have to rebuild their in-game decision process on the fly.
The baseball angle matters beyond sports, because MLB's tablet ban is effectively a position statement on competitive integrity. The league's concern isn't that AI makes decisions. It's that AI access creates competitive asymmetry between teams that adopted it and teams that didn't. That's a real fairness argument. But it also sets up a fascinating parallel with every other competitive domain, from financial markets to academic testing. Do you ban AI to preserve a legacy definition of human skill, or do you accept that the definition of skill is evolving? Baseball has always evolved its rules, the designated hitter, the pitch clock, but typically more slowly than this.
The United Airlines story about offering free rebookings away from what is apparently now called Trump Airport, the renamed West Palm Beach facility, is a small story that reflects a broader consumer behavior dynamic. United is explicitly allowing passengers to avoid a renamed airport based on political objection. There's a commercial logic to it. The airline is reducing friction for customers who would otherwise be frustrated, and the cost of the rebooking is lower than the reputational cost of forcing travelers through a branded facility they'd rather avoid. It's also a notable example of a major corporation accommodating politically motivated consumer preferences without taking a public political stance itself.
The Hegseth Blue Angels story is worth a brief stop. A Blue Angels jet flew what witnesses described as dangerously low over Pensacola Beach, triggering a Navy safety review. Defense Secretary Hegseth responded by posting "Until morale improves" on X and vowing the flyovers would continue. There's a meaningful gap between the tone of that response and the Navy's own safety review, which by definition takes the incident seriously. The tension between political leadership wanting to project strength and military safety culture, which treats near-miss incidents as mandatory learning events, is a real institutional friction point.
Now, the Suno scraping revelation deserves more time than we gave it in the cybersecurity segment because it has distinct cultural implications. iMusic Generation has been positioned as a democratizing technology, giving anyone the ability to produce professional-sounding music without instruments or training. But if the foundation of that capability was built by ingesting millions of songs from professional musicians without authorization or compensation, the ethical architecture is deeply compromised. The hack that revealed Suno's source code is not yet publicly adjudicated. The company hasn't confirmed the leaked code's authenticity, but the specificity of the reporting makes wholesale fabrication unlikely.
And now, our what if we're wrong exercise for this week, because I think there's a claim embedded in the Ukraine shadow fleet coverage that deserves harder scrutiny. The confident claim is this: striking 159 Russian shadow fleet vessels in 12 days is crippling Russia's oil export capacity and will meaningfully constrain its war financing.
I'm going to push back on my own instincts here, because when I first saw that number, I treated it as self-evidently significant. But let me try to steelman the counterargument. What would need to be true for this campaign to be less effective than it appears? First, the 159 figure might count vessels hit by any means, including drone strikes that damaged but didn't sink ships. A vessel with surface damage can be repaired and returned to service. The metric we actually want is vessels permanently removed from operation, and that number might be substantially lower.
Second, and this is the structural point that I think gets underweighted, the shadow fleet is not a fixed asset pool with a firm ceiling. Russia has been actively acquiring and enlisting additional vessels throughout the war, including through intermediaries in Turkey, the UAE, and India. If the acquisition rate even partially offsets the attrition rate, the net impact on Russian oil export volume could be much smaller than the strike numbers suggest. We don't have good public data on Russian shadow fleet acquisition velocity to compare against the attrition rate.
Third, oil market prices. If this campaign were genuinely crippling Russian export capacity, we'd expect to see Russian Urals crude either backed up at export terminals or rising in price as buyers compete for remaining supply. The current Urals discount to Brent has actually narrowed somewhat, which is a signal that Russian oil is still reaching markets. That's circumstantial, but it's a data point that cuts against the strong form of the claim.
So what do we watch for? Three specific indicators. First, satellite imagery of Russian oil export terminals. If tankers are queuing up unable to load because fleet capacity is genuinely degraded, that will show up in commercial shipping data. Second, Urals crude pricing. A sustained widening of the Urals discount to Brent would indicate buyers are having difficulty accessing Russian supply. Third, Russian central bank foreign reserve data. If oil revenue is actually being squeezed, it will eventually show up in reserve drawdowns. Those three data streams will tell us whether the shadow fleet campaign is hitting as hard as the headline numbers suggest, or whether Russia has found sufficient workarounds to blunt the impact.